Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day. It is Wednesday, March 17th. John, let's say before you got married, were you completely open? Did you talk about all money?
I'm not talking about this.
You refuse to talk about money with me.
In fact, I'm going to change the subject and talk about the news. In fact, right now,
typical.
Let's check in on the top stories in the news. The big question on Capitol Hill this week, will House Democrats have enough votes to pass health care reform? House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer tells ABC News this morning.
We think we'll have the votes when the roll is called.
At this time, Democrats appear to be somewhat short of the 216 votes they need. A vote is expected Friday or Saturday. Meanwhile, some religious leaders are telling undocumented immigrants in the United States not to fill out census forms. The Reverend Miguel Rivera is the chairman of a coalition of 20,000 churches.
How in the world are we going to ask undocumented immigrants to trust and to open the door where they have no assurances that that information will be confidential? I will not be used against them.
Other religious leaders and census officials say confidentiality is not a problem and that a boycott is actually counterproductive.
The Homeland Security Department is cutting millions of dollars intended for a high-tech virtual fence along the Mexican border. Secretary Napolitano says about $50 million in stimulus money will go toward radios and cameras instead. And we're looking this morning at the racial gap in terms of wealth in this country, specifically how minority women are doing financially compared to their white counterparts. We're joined now by Esther Bush. She's president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh, and she works on educating the urban poor about how to save their money. Good morning, Esther.
Good morning.
Those numbers I cited at the top of the show are from a new study that I know you've looked at, and I'm wondering if you were surprised by this wide gap, how wide this gap is between black and Hispanic women and their white counterparts.
Yes, I knew the gap was wide, but it is even worse than I had predicted. There are things that we really need to address in this country to close that gap.
And we're going to be asking you more about what those things are that we need to do. Esther Bush, stay with us.
In Israel, tensions remain high this morning after violence on the streets of Jerusalem yesterday. Meanwhile, the White House has reiterated its strong bonds with the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, attempting to heal a historic rift between the U.S. and Israel. The Prime Minister of Israel will visit Washington next week. In Pakistan this morning, five Americans were charged with planning terrorist attacks against that country. The men, all Muslims from the Washington, D.C. area, have pleaded not guilty to the charges. They face life in prison if convicted.
And happy St. Patrick's Day to our Irish listeners. That's the sound of Irish step dancers in Dublin's St. Patrick's Day parade, courtesy of CBS News. Ireland's President, Mary McInnes, paid tribute today to the 70 million people of Irish descent celebrating around the world. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will get underway this hour at 10,685, the S&P at 1,159, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,378. So we start this new series this week, which obviously John will not be participating in since he can't talk about money.
I'm just so guilty.
We're going to be talking about how to do it yourself, a do-it-yourself financial bailout. And we're wondering, what's a financially taboo topic? Clearly for John, everything. But what will you not talk about? Personal finances too personal? And all right, let's go a little step further. Are you willing to tell us how much you make? How much money do you make? What's your salary?
Can't do that. Can't do it.
Oh, John. Give us your stories, since John won't. At 877-8-MY-TAKE, we're going to be talking more about that later this hour.
Serious discussion of the racial gender gap in poverty.
Income does not equal wealth. That's because between the amount of your paycheck and how much you actually put in the bank, there's all those other things like your debt and your expenses that you have to pay. You may not be able to keep much of your income. But wealth means financial security. So what we now know is that there's actually a racial gap when it comes to employment. But even for those who are employed, for those who have a good income, there's still a racial gap in terms of wealth. And it's especially bad for women of color. Here are some of the numbers, not including the cars they own. Let's set cars aside. The average single white woman has about $4,000 in assets. The average Hispanic woman has $120. And the average African-American woman, only about $100. We've got Ella Edmondson Bell with us to talk about this. She's a professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School, and she joins us from North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you explain to me why this is? Why is there such a huge, a vast gap between the races on the issue of wealth?
Well, I think one reason is that there is such a thing as generational wealth, wealth that is passed down from our parents, our grandparents. African-American women, Hispanic women, we come from families where there is not, where we don't get a leg up from generational wealth because our parents and our grandparents didn't have that wealth to pass down to us. So we start at the short end of the stick. The next problem is that we are in industries and in jobs that do not give us the good fringe benefits. We don't get the big bonuses. We don't get good pension plans. We don't get health plans. So those monies have to be put out in other ways. So not only do we not bring it in terms of salary, we're not getting the fringe benefits that often come with salary that allows us to put more money away.
Ella, there's also another issue that I was interested to read about, and that's that sometimes the expenses themselves are higher. For example, there's a lot of instances of redlining in urban communities on the parts of insurance companies, so they're paying higher insurance rate for their homes and their cars. Their expenses
very
are higher.
So. And if you look at the latest mortgage fiasco, many African American women were caught up on that in terms of the types of mortgages that they were able to get, and that those mortgages were the high prime mortgages, subprime mortgages, and fell through the cracks and required much more money with less house. And then there's the other reality that many of the women we're talking about are either single, divorced, and single heads of households. So there's not a double income there to consider. So there's even less money to put away. A woman is responsible for not only providing food, clothing, and shelter, but daycare and everything else for her family on a very low income rate.
Okay, so there's a lot of contributing factors here.
This should not come as a big, big surprise, to be honest with you.
Okay, let's go back to Esther Bush, who heads the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh. Esther, you take all these contributing factors and you say, well, listen, there's still things that you can do about that, right? For this public that you serve, the community that you serve, you're trying to help them out through financial literacy, trying to help them get better mortgages, get better loans, right?
Absolutely. And the information that was just shared, we see it every single day. And it's important for your entire listening audience to understand the impact of all of those things over decades and generations. Right now, we have a mortgage foreclosure program with women coming in, and it is some of the deals that the mortgage owners are trying to have these women sign are unbelievable. I even took a couple of them to my board meeting, and the head of my board, who is an attorney, he read the paper and literally opened his mouth. He could not believe that a firm, a bank, a mortgage company was asking somebody to sign papers that if my mortgage is $300 today and I can't pay it, how am I going to pay you $450 over the next X amount of months to catch up? So even some of the remedies are just really, truly ridiculous. And the way things are designed, they're designed seemingly to keep these women and other poor, low-income people in the hole.
Okay, well, explain to me, what are the number one and number two things that someone can do who's in this situation? Maybe somebody has a good income and they want to start building their assets and building their wealth. What are the first things they should do?
The first thing they should do is put themselves on a budget, and no matter the amount of their income, make sure that they put aside something to save. People always say, or typically say, you know, I don't make enough to save. Yes, you do. If it's $5 a paycheck, if it's $10, until you can get up to $100 or whatever is affordable for you, because what's critically important is to begin the habit, is to begin to understand the critical importance of savings and understanding how that savings can swell over time.
Okay, Ella, explain to me, is there a cultural gap here as well? We're talking about minority communities in which Esther is talking about a financial literacy problem where she's trying to help them get loans that are to their advantage and help them get fair insurance rates. Is there a cultural gap?
I think there is an exposure issue. If my mother and father had to work doubly hard just to keep a roof over my head, make sure I was fed, we didn't talk about necessarily savings. We didn't talk about stock. We didn't talk about investment. I think that is an issue that plagues our community. We are in a position where we don't have a lot of extra income at all. So ways that we can build wealth, particularly ways that whites have the opportunity to do because they've been exposed early on. I mean, many of my students, for example, at the Tuck School of Business have had stock since they were children. That was an event, a game that they had with their parents. Each birthday, they got shares in stock and would follow it. You don't have that in our communities because we just don't have the knowledge, but we also don't have the monies to put aside like that, quite honestly. So the ways that whites in their culture, many of them who can build wealth, we just don't have access to that.
That's Ella Edmondson-Bell, professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, and Esther Bush is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh. Thanks to both of you. And now let's check in on the top stories at 15 minutes after the hour.
We begin with Capitol Hill health care reform. Another day of arm twisting as President Obama sits down with wavering or reluctant House Democrats today. Opponents of the president's plans continue to run ad campaigns to kill the current bill. Meanwhile, a bill to encourage businesses to hire unemployed workers is expected to clear Congress today. It faces a vote in the Senate. The measure would give companies a temporary payroll tax holiday. Some economic news in the past hour. Prices at the wholesale level are showing their biggest drop in 7 months. They fell in February by 0.6%. And some experts are calling a robbery in Connecticut, quote, one of the biggest pharmaceutical heists in history. Thieves, bold thieves, made off with $75 million worth of prescription drugs. We're going to have more on that heist very, very shortly.
Religious leaders disagree on whether undocumented immigrants in their congregation should complete census forms. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez says any kind of boycott of the census would be foolish.
If we boycott the census, we're boycotting representation, number one. Number two, we are boycotting funds and resources for better schools, more police officers, community development.
And finally, it is St. Patrick's Day. The Irish tenor. Ireland is hoping to get a tourist bump out of today's celebrations. The country's main tourism agency has managed to get a number of major world landmarks to go green. One example, the Sydney Opera House today, bathed in green light. And at the White House, President Obama meets with the Irish Prime Minister, Brian Cohen. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, Tiger returning to golf.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout sounds like a TV movie. It's that unbelievable. Christine Dempsey joins us now, staff reporter for the Hartford Courant, where in Enfield, Connecticut, nearby you, Christine, some thieves got away with $75 million worth of pharmaceutical drugs. What are the details? And good morning to you.
Good morning. This was a real Mission Impossible style theft. This is something that the town of Enfield, Connecticut has never, ever seen before. What happened was there were some thieves, more than one definitely, who planned this well-thought-out heist. They scaled the outside walls of a warehouse in Enfield. They cut a hole in the roof, and they slid down ropes to get inside. They quickly disarmed the alarm, and over the course of a few hours, they stole several dozens of pallets of prescription drug medication.
And these are huge skids that have boxes of drugs that are labeled sitting around the warehouse, right? And this is an Eli Lilly warehouse.
Yes, that was Eli Lilly, and they have a warehouse there. It is on the East Coast distribution facility.
And I gather the people at the Eli Lilly company, or at least this warehouse, are probably going through personnel records this morning. I mean, this sounds like an inside job of some sort.
I had the same thought. I asked Police Chief Carl Safraza this morning that question. I asked him yesterday also, and he said they don't want to just go with one theory at this point. He wants his detectives to be open-minded about how they handle this and how they do this investigation. So they are considering all possibilities at this point.
Christine Dempsey, any sense of the black market for these drugs? You've got Prozac, you've got Cymbalta, Zyprexa. These are some of Eli Lilly's best-selling drugs last year. No painkillers or narcotics taken. These are antidepressants.
Correct, exactly. But as you know, certainly prescription drugs are very, very expensive. And there is a black market, so to speak. Online, people can buy drugs online, unfortunately, that may be obtained illegally. In other countries, too, like South America or Asia, where drug regulations are lax, it's more common that these would be sold. These aren't the types of drugs that are going to surface at the local CVS, though.
But it's interesting what you're saying. These are not necessarily drug abusers who are the market for these drugs. These are people possibly diagnosed with bipolar disorder and actual maladies who are trying to get discounts over the retail price of prescriptions.
Good point. I mean, maybe unknowingly, certainly, you know, people may be trying to get a good bargain on the internet and they may end up buying illegal drugs, but that's true.
Well, lots of the details remain to be discovered here. Christine Dempsey covering the story of the heist in Enfield, Connecticut, where thieves scaled the walls of an Eli Lilly warehouse and made off with $75 million worth of pills. Just could be a snapshot of the healthcare industry unwittingly there by those thieves. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
If there's one thing that could out-headline NCAA March Madness, it would be Tiger Woods. And Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen here is to talk about Tiger's return to golf at the upcoming Masters in Augusta, Georgia. The big question, whether or not he's going to be able to perform as well as he did in the past before all the scandals. Ibrahim, will he be able to retain his focus in light of everything that's happened to him?
Well, this is the first time he's going to be playing on a golf course in competition since November 15th when he won the Australian Masters in Melbourne. That was his 82nd career victory. So now he's returning after all the scandal, after all the treatment. And I think this is the ideal place for him to return because Augusta really controls the environment for the Masters. So if you heckle, if you're out of line, you get kicked out. It's not like the U.S. Open where it's just kind of like this massive stuff.
Still, I mean, it's like being under a microscope and in a stadium at the same time.
And I think he knows this course well. He's played here. He's played extremely well here. So I think this is the ideal setting for Tiger to return. And like I said before, when this first came out, I have a feeling Tiger's going to play extremely well. He doesn't really know how to be a father or a husband. Those are all new things to him. But out of all the things that he knows how to do, he knows how to play golf. And now that he'll get back into a competition arena, I think he's going to play extremely well.
You don't think that this has shaken him? And I mean, golf, John was saying this morning, golf is really about focus, about quieting your mind and just focusing.
I think this is part of he's still in treatment. So he says that he's still in treatment. He's still going through this making the changes in his personal life. This is actually, to me, part of his treatment. If he can sort of hone in and focus, I think for him, golf is a meditative space and a meditative state. And he'll have the chatter from being a cheat and a liar in his personal life away. So this will kind of, the seas are kind of parted personally for him. So I think he's going to actually be able to focus even more because it's kind of like what happened with A-Rod where he was using steroids and he wasn't playing as well. Well, now all that stuff quieted away, and he was able to really focus on the game.
And Tiger Woods is a practicing Buddhist. I mean, you got to figure maybe he's going to bring a busload of Buddhist priests along to sort of stay behind him, to kind of crowd around him, to keep him quiet.
No, wait, the Dalai Lama didn't even know who Tiger Woods was. That's
very Buddhist. You have to admit, that's very Buddhist.
It is very Buddhist. But, you know, here's the thing. Tiger is going to be under more the pressure is higher now than ever before because if he fails, it's so predictable. His entire life, you know, crashes and burns. He just, you know, he was once great and now will wash up. And yet, if he succeeds, everyone says, well, he's put that all behind him and he can get back to, I mean, the pressure, the stakes could not be higher.
The most important thing for him to do is make the cut. And I think for the television ratings, this is going to be critical. This is going to be a huge, one of the most watched golf matches, tournaments in history because of Tiger's return. So I think,
unless he's out in the first round.
Exactly. So I think the focus is for Tiger. If Tiger does well early on and he makes the cut and he gets into the, starts to do well early, then we'll see. Then we can start talking about Tiger winning, and that'll create this huge storm of energy and interest. So I think for him, he's just focusing on what's in front of him.
It's almost the only way he's going to be able to put this behind.
Without a doubt.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much. Coming up, the healthcare battle may be ending soon, but how did we get here? What's the beginning, middle, and the end of the healthcare reform story? Also, later this hour, we're going to start a new series called DIY Bailout, you helping yourself with your own bailout. And we're asking you, are there money topics that are taboo? Do you not like to talk about money? Will you not talk about money? And how much do you make? Is that a taboo question? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE. More about this later this hour.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, seeking the narrative in the healthcare reform debate. When there's not even an ending yet, a filmmaker struggles to find the story in healthcare reform. That's in just a few moments, but let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. More about that healthcare battle. We're learning this morning, even if Democrats don't get the votes in the House, they might try another way to pass the bill. It's an arcane procedure where the Senate bill would be deemed to have passed if House members voted in favor of a separate bill with health care provisions attached. Republicans say Democrats shouldn't use the tactic with a bill of this magnitude, but House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer had this to say on ABC News this morning.
Unfortunately, the Republicans are a little bit like the boy who killed his two parents and then wants sympathy because they're an orphan.
A House vote is expected Friday or Saturday. We'll have more on this story in just a moment.
The Pentagon is trying to curb the abuse of painkillers by soldiers. Military doctors wrote almost 4 million prescriptions for painkillers last year. That's more than four times the doses handed out in 2001. But officials say the increase reflects the continuing toll of fighting two major wars. And Facebook has edged out Google as the most visited website in the U.S. Facebook previously had reached the number one rank on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, a few other days, but it had never kept the top spot for a full week. Until now, Facebook accounted for over 7% of all internet visits in the U.S. last week. New economic numbers out this morning show wholesale prices are showing their largest drop in 7 months. They fell in February by 0.6% as the decrease in energy prices offset higher food costs. Taking a look at the markets, the Dow is up 30, the S&P is up 3, and the NASDAQ is up about 5. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Good morning, everyone. We're joined now by Michael Kirk, who's a Frontline producer. And on April 13th, his film Obama's Deal will air. Frontline, of course, is a production of our partner WGBH in Boston. Good morning, Michael Kirk.
Good morning, John.
Who joins us from the Boston area. And you don't have an ending to this film, do you yet?
Not yet, and I'm crossing my fingers one way or the other. The film will end, but it's whether it's a happy ending for the president or a less happy ending.
And the happy ending also would refer either, depending on how you believe politically, for all American citizens who have something at stake in this debate. Michael Kirk, it seems to me, and we've got some excerpts from your film. Here's Dan Pfeiffer, a White House communications director, and this comes directly from your film, which is currently in the edit room right now, that the stakes of this entire battle here are pretty neatly laid out in this remark right here.
We were sitting in the Oval Office as we were sort of having a debate around healthcare at one point. The president said, it's about healthcare, but it's not really about healthcare. It's also about proving whether we can still solve big problems in this country. And this was going to be the test case for that.
Now, Michael Kirk, when did that meeting take place that Dan Pfeiffer is referring to? And did the president really launch this entire narrative by saying, can we solve big problems in the United States anymore?
Well, he launched it, I think, way back when he was running for the presidency and said and promised to try to change the culture and the way of operating in Washington. Healthcare, I think, was his test case, the case study that he would use to try to change the narrative of the way the pernicious politics of our country have been run for a number of presidencies. This particular meeting happened very early in the presidency when Joe Biden and others sat around and said, absolutely not. Don't take on universal health care. I've seen it eat too many presidencies alive.
Wow.
At the same time that Geithner and Summers were sitting in there saying, we've got an economy that's crashing. You got to pay attention to job one. But President Obama wanted an issue that he thought could demonstrate how different his presidency would be, and health care became that issue.
And he began to acquire the allies who would help to shape that message and to shape the entire narrative going forward. What's the first milestone, as you see it in this story, really, and it begins right after the election?
it's a very interesting case of an outsider suddenly surrounding himself, because I think he probably realized he had to, and the advice he was receiving was he had to. He had surrounded himself with insiders, former people who had worked in Congress all around the West Wing, including Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff. But the primary person he brought in was one of the great Washington quintessential insiders, Tom Daschle, who'd been the majority leader for the Democrats and had been unelected by the people in his home state, and was at the time a health care lobbyist, or not a lobbyist legally, but a person who advocated for health care groups in Washington and very well known to the president.
And, you know, as you say, former majority leader in the Senate and a powerful person in Washington, and some have called him the most knowledgeable person on health care. But almost immediately that choice went south. Here's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show on February 2nd, 2009.
I do want to say a quick word to anyone out there who wants to bring change and hope to a deeply divided and suffering America. Pay your f***ing taxes. We're not asking you to be perfect. You want to be in the cabinet? We're not saying you can't throw a little under the table to the Guatemalan nanny. You're not saying you can't accept a couple of thanks for your help fruit baskets from the boys down at Local 238. But Tom Daschle? Obama's pick for health secretary?
Here, Michael Kirk, frontline producer, you see the cynicism that now suffuses this entire debate on health care reform starting to sweep in.
It begins literally, it's a great clip because it begins literally right at that moment. He's less than a month in, and he loses his primary point person on the issue because of the not only taxes, but he gets Daschle gets eaten alive by a rival in the Senate, Max Baucus, and Baucus's kind of partner on the Senate Finance Committee, the Republican Senator Charles Grassley.
And if the original turning point in this debate was the acquisition of Rahm Emanuel as sort of chief of staff for the president, someone with a aggressive reputation for working on Capitol Hill, the demise of Tom Daschle being another turning point. Things really, really turned in the summer of 2009. Describe what you think is the critical turning point in the summer of 2009.
One of the things that Obama needed if he was going to get the bill passed was speed. It had to happen while the new president still had some juice. What happened with the Republicans was they intentionally slowed it down so that across the summer it was like heavy boots walking in mud over at Congress to try to get anything done. What they were essentially doing...
Here's the sound of some of those boots. This comes directly from your film. Do you think the president walked into this?
I think he did, sort of unknowingly. They hadn't really anticipated the anger and the fervor and the ability of Republicans and others, including indigenous movements like the Tea Party movement, to stoke it up and make it happen when Congress went home in August. And that really took it right to the precipice, that is the health care bill.
Well, your film will air April 13th, where we will know the outcome here. Where do you think we are right now before we go, Michael Kirk?
I think we're right on the edge, John. I think the president is counting votes. If he had them, there'd be a vote on it. We'd be hearing about it right now. He still doesn't have them, even a year into this process.
If you had a camera anywhere in Washington right now, where would you want it?
I'd be right over Rahm Emanuel's shoulder.
Ooh, good call. There may be some of those POV shots in the Frontline special, Obama's Deal, produced by my guest Michael Kirk, producer for the forthcoming documentary. It'll be broadcast by Frontline and our partner station, WGBH, on April 13th. Thanks to Michael Kirk for joining us. We start a new series this week, DIY Bailout. How can you help yourself out of financial straits since you don't have the TARP to help you in Washington? We start off talking about why finances is a taboo subject between family and friends. What about your personal finances? Do you find it hardest to share with other people? And let's try this honestly. Are you willing to tell us what you make? How much?
This is Kelly from South Carolina. I went from making close to $30,000 in 2008 with two jobs to making $14,000 in 2009 due to maternity leave and loss of my main job. So that was kind of a hit.
Ooh, thanks for sharing, but ouch. Share your salary and your taboo financial subjects at 877-8-MY-TAKE. More on that later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. One way that we know that the Detroit public schools are in crisis is that they have an emergency financial manager. His name is Robert Bob. Another way that we know that is that Robert Bob has announced the city will close 45 more schools this year. This is part of his plan, Robert Bob's plan, to fix the city's failing school system. And to talk more about it, we have Noah Ovshinsky from Detroit. He's an education reporter for our member station, WDET. And Noah, you've been covering the Detroit city schools pretty much for as long as you've been reporting in Detroit. So tell me about this plan to close 45 schools. Is that a positive thing, or is this kind of an indication that the school system is dying?
Well, Celeste, it depends on what side you fall on. If you're a student or a parent, in the short term, it means a lot of disruption. It means that if you're a student that's been in DPS for at least 5 or 6 years, chances are you've moved schools at least once. So there is a lot of disruption that comes with this plan. If you're the district, it means you're saving a lot of money. This $31 million alone, if they close the full 45 buildings this year. So it all depends on what side of the line you fall on.
I would imagine that some of this is just related to the fact that the population of the city of Detroit has shrunk, that this is a city that was built to accommodate millions of people and now has maybe 800 or 900,000 people in it.
Yeah, to give you a flavor of the situation, Celeste, the district has 84,000 students this year. It's lost about 10,000 students a year for the last decade, and they're expecting enrollment to drop to as low as 56,000 by 2014. So there is a need to shrink the physical size of the district only because there are so many empty seats. That's due to declining enrollment. That's due to parents losing their job and moving out of the moving out of the city, or students going to other districts outside of DPS. They live in the city, but they go to charters and private schools and parochial schools.
Well, here is Robert Bob telling reporters about this plan to shrink the school system.
We must reduce and eliminate our deficit. We must cut non-critical spending to create a smaller, more agile system with increased flexibility, credibility, and accountability.
Okay, and part of this more agile system means that people are going to be losing their jobs.
Yeah, we don't know exactly how many and what kind of jobs are going to be lost. We know that when you eliminate 45 buildings, many of those schools, you're going to lose teachers, you're going to lose principals and assistant principals and engineers. So yeah, there's going to be a lot fewer people working in the district if this plan goes through. That said, the academic nature of the district is going to change drastically. Most of the schools now will be pre-K through 8, which is an increasing movement throughout the country. And also, they're going to create larger campuses from pre-K through full colleges. They're going to bring colleges in on some of these big campuses to teach classes to some of their students.
How much is the Detroit public school system in the red right now, Noah?
Well, it depends on the day, Celeste, but today I believe it's about $316 million in the red.
That's a lot of change, and hopefully closing schools will bring them closer, but we don't know by how much?
This year alone, we're looking at a savings of $31 million with the closings. And of course, over time, they're looking at several more millions being saved.
If I do my math right, that's still over $250 million of red ink. Noah Ovshinsky is an education reporter for WDET, our member station in Detroit. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry on this St. Patrick's Day. And we're starting a new series this week. It's called DIY Bailout, how you can help yourself out of financial trouble. And the
first one is like admitting you have a problem.
Well, you know, there's the 12 steps, right, for alcohol
problems. Don't remind
me. With money, there's also some steps. And the first one is the same as for 12 steps. It's admit you have a problem, which means you have to talk about it, which is a problem for a lot of people. They can't talk about it. And we're asking you, what are your financial taboos? What can you not talk about when it comes to money? And let's try some honesty. Are you willing to tell us how much you make? Mike emails us, if you're willing to tell, it's not enough. Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE, and we'll talk more about it in a few minutes. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama gets ready for another day of working on health care reform. He'll sit down with wavering House Democrats today. Meanwhile, advocacy groups are running ad campaigns in districts where Democratic lawmakers are thought to be on the fence. 5 young Americans are being held in Pakistan, and they've been charged with planning terror attacks. The men, all Muslims from the Washington, D.C. area, have pleaded not guilty to the charges.
And police in Enfield, Connecticut, are looking for thieves who last night in a brazen warehouse raid made off with $75 million worth of Eli Lilly prescription drugs, mostly anti-drug antidepressants. What does that mean, about the criminals needing that many antidepressants? Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Check your credit report.
Do it yourself.
Manage money.
Your income tax.
Where's your bailout?
Saving for college.
Negotiate the best price.
We're supposed to haggle.
Start saving.
Retirement.
Bailout.
Do it yourself.
Where's your bailout?
Do it yourself.
So for the past year, we've heard a lot about bailouts, bailouts for the car industry, bailouts for the American financial system. The big banks got a bailout. What happened to our bailout? Who's going to come in and bail out the average American citizen? Takeaway contributor Beth Koblenzer has an answer to that question. You are going to bail yourself out. We have a new series that we start today called Do It Yourself Bailout. It's a 10-part series. And this week, the question is, why can't we talk about money? Why is it so hard to talk about personal finances? It's just plain difficult. Keeping silent may be more comfortable, but it's also perhaps not healthy and certainly not good for your finances. Beth Koblenzer is author of Get a Financial Life. She's here to help us break this silence. Also with us, Stephen Goldbart, a psychologist and co-director of the Money, Meaning, and Choices Institute. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
So Beth, first of all, let's kind of get an idea about this, because people come to you for answers, financial answers, right?
Right. All the time.
Are they agonized? I mean, what does it take to bring them to you?
Well, I think the main thing is we've all heard about this $11 trillion bailout. And I've been seeing people now wearing T-shirts saying, where's my bailout? And we see right now that there's 6 million Americans who have been unemployed for 6 months or longer, which is the longest period since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been keeping this figure since 1948. So there's such a long period of time where people are out of work, and it's devastating for them. Meanwhile, they have $8,000 in credit card debt on average. One in four American homeowners are underwater, meaning they owe more than their home is worth. People have depleted their savings. And so we decided to do this takeaway bailout movement to get people up and learn about, you know, how to save, what are the secrets behind your credit score, how do you get out of debt, all those questions that you've asked me, everybody's asked me, and we're going to try to figure them out for people.
Okay, but Stephen, this is a question for you, because I was unemployed for just about 6 months. It was very, very difficult financially, and clearly I have a lot of house cleaning financially to do to recover from that, which I'm sure a lot of people are in that situation. And what I discovered when I started talking to my friends about this is that nobody wanted to talk about it. And when I finally did broach the subject, they were almost relieved to have a place to vent that. So what is this that makes us feel this personal shame over money issues?
Yeah, it's really true that money today is the issue that sex was maybe 50 years ago in terms of still being taboo and uncomfortable. And then when people just turn on the faucet, everyone's ready to just talk about it. That's because, in part, it's a lightning rod issue. Money is just loaded with emotional issues such as love, control, self-esteem, sexuality, and power. So it's very hard to have a conversation about money that's just about the money. People feel that when you ask them about money, you're asking them, you know, do you have or do you not have self-esteem? Have you made it? Are you likable? Are you dressed for success? You know, how well is your life going? In effect, in this country, money overdetermines, you know, who we are, our self-esteem, and what we are as people.
You know, Beth, I actually have a friend of mine who actually leaves her credit card bill sitting there until it's late because she doesn't want to open it, and she has the money to pay for it.
Yeah.
You must see people like this all the time.
Absolutely. You know, most people I know so little about it because they were never taught anything about it. But I have to say, personally, when I go to the doctor and I say I used to write for Money Magazine, and the doctor says, oh, I love Money Magazine, I usually run the other way because I want my doctor to read JAMA. I don't want my doctor to read Money Magazine.
I agree.
I find people who are passionate about their careers or their families, we all have such busy lives. We don't really have that much time to focus on our money. It's not really all that fun. And we're busy doing so many other things. And those who do have time, you know, people are frightened. It is really overwhelming and scary to focus in on this topic that we don't know much about.
My wife and I have discovered that when you do it, mm-hmm. though, when you actually do get into it,
right.
it's actually, there's so much to talk about and so much to do there. It can be a bonding mechanism. It can actually be helpful.
Absolutely. That's the point.
You got to get over the hurdle.
You got to get over the hurdle. And I think the way to do that is by just diving in there, small steps at a time, like anything else in life. You get into the nitty gritty, you figure it out. And by talking about it, you really get to the nuggets of what we need to do as a couple or as
here,
a family.
Here, honey, here are my receipts. That's what we do.
That sounds so romantic.
But Stephen, you know, how do you get people to get over this fear of admitting things, of giving, even if they go to somebody like Beth Koblenzer and they're trying to get their finances together, oftentimes I bet they don't even give her the whole story. They're embarrassed to tell her how bad they think things are. How do you get people over that?
Well, I think we first have to start by facing that we are uncomfortable with this, and that work on separating our financial worth from our self-worth, and say to ourselves, okay, you know, this is going to be hard, but I'm just going to take that first step to get started. You know, none of us have been taught to be emotionally intelligent about money, mm-hmm. and most of us have not been taught, you know, the financial basics, and the kind of holes that people find themselves in have a whole lot to do with the way in which our society has, you know, pressed us to buy, to purchase, to consume, but hasn't helped us understand what it means to manage our money. And another important point here, a conversation about money doesn't have to be boring. Ultimately, a conversation that you begin to have with yourself or with people in your life about money can be a conversation about what really matters to you most.
It's kind of 12-step-y here.
The values and the principles that you want to have drive your life.
I'm John Hockenberry, and I bought an electric guitar in my 50s that I couldn't afford.
There we go. You said it. But also, I think a lot of it's about financial literacy. I often say to people, could you save $50 a month? They're like, no, I can't. It's impossible. I'm like, well, how about $2 a day? And they're like, oh, sure. Well, $2 a day. Of course I can. I'm like, well, you know what? If you can save $2 a day, you can save. You can even save $60 a month. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, that kind of click. You know, a British study found that 1 in 7 people would say they prefer to visit a dentist rather than see a financial planner. So I feel like we're at this point.
How does that make you feel,
Brits? Yeah. I know. I think we're at the point where people are afraid, but perhaps the silver lining in this terrible economic situation that many people are feeling, and it's, you know, it's very serious and very grave, is that it's forced a lot of people to come to terms with, I'm in this dire situation, how do I get out of it? How do I pay attention to these issues at this very difficult time, and where do I start?
Do you generally find when people come to you, Beth, that things are worse than they think they are, or do people generally think of themselves that they're in worse financial shape, they're in better financial shape than they thought?
I think, you know, as a journalist, I talk to people of all different ranges, but I think people are more scared, and it's this big, scary, you know, hole that they don't even want to go at and look at. And then when they look at the specifics, they're like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, it takes 3 phone calls and just to get it in order. Of course, it takes many, many years to pay off this debt. But once I'm on track, it's a little less scarier than I thought.
Well, Madoff was still scary, though.
I think we're missing out on a whole horror film genre here.
Indeed.
Beth Koblenzer is author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s, and of course, we're a takeaway contributor. And thanks to Stephen Goldbart, psychologist and wealth consultant, co-director of the Money, Meaning, and Choices Institute. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a story to share with us about this, tell us, what do your personal finances do that you find is hardest to share about with other people? A listener in Portland posts on our site, thetakeaway.org, I find it difficult to discuss the fact that my husband and I are not in financial distress. I feel guilty for our good fortune, although it's partly due to our conservative spending and investments, but I never tell my friends how much we make. And Shannon
That's
in Brooklyn, Connecticut, emails, my husband went from making $53,000 in 2008 to bringing in less than $15,000 in 2009. That's due to our having to move cross-country so I could keep my job from Arizona to Massachusetts. The company he worked for decided they couldn't accommodate a job transfer. He's been tempted for a year to go to the exact same company that he left. They have a hiring freeze that's keeping him from hiring him back. Give us your story. This interesting story is behind money and why people don't explain. Sometimes it's complicated. Maybe that's why. 877-8-
53K to 15K. Ouch. That's
big. You can follow this entire series, a 10-part series, and see Beth's lists of tips for people who want to start getting themselves in order. You can check that out at our blog, thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.